This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is in Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates, today. His foreign minister met with his counterpart in Turkey's capital, Ankara, and the Speaker of Iraq's parliament heads for Iran and Bahrain tomorrow. The diplomatic offensive comes in support of the 24-point National Reconciliation Plan proposed a week ago that offers limited amnesty to mainly Sunni insurgents if they renounce violence and join the political process. The reconciliation plan follows a couple of rare successes: the death of Musab al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and the installation, at long last, of a complete roster of cabinet ministers in a coalition government that includes all of the major groups and factions. But with the political initiative barely off the ground, there's concern that it's already been overtaken by events. A car bomb over the weekend killed 66 people in a market, and the violence continues without let-up. At least 10 people were reported dead today. A former American soldier has been charged in an investigation into allegations that a group of soldiers raped and murdered a young woman in Mahmoudiya last March and then killed three members of her family in an effort to cover up the crime. And Sunni legislators boycotted Parliament today to protest the abduction of one of their colleagues, a woman seized along with seven of her bodyguards in a Shiite neighborhood of Baghdad on Saturday. Later in the program, the human brain is on the Talk of the Nation opinion page. A Harvard psychologist argues that we're exquisitely adapted to respond to immediate problems, terrorism, say, but not so good at more probable but distant dangers, like global warming. But first, the prospects of national reconciliation in Iraq. If you have questions about the program, about what it addresses, what it doesn't, or about how it's been received in Iraq, our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And we turn first to Michael Rubin, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, editor of the Middle East Quarterly. He joins us by telephone today from New Hope, Pennsylvania. Nice to speak with you again.
Good speaking with you again.
And I understand you're just back from Iraq a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, I spent the first half of June there.
And what do you make of this broad-ranging reconciliation plan? It has amnesty at its heart, but obviously much wider goals.
Well, I'm not that optimistic, to be perfectly honest. In theory, reconciliation always sounds good. I'm not sure whether it works, and B, there's a couple questions about what the amnesty plan would mean. If it does forgive folks that have engaged in violence against Iraqis and killed Americans, then it really just takes away any disincentive to engage politically and creates another round of violence potentially. And if it only endorses the nonviolent, if it only forgives the nonviolent participation, and that's what Prime Minister Maliki now says, then it really doesn't do anything, because if you haven't engaged in violence, what do you need amnesty from?
He does say that those who have killed Iraqis and Americans or members of the coalition, more broadly, would not be eligible for this.
Right. He's clarified that under pressure after some initial couple days of debate.
There's another aspect of this which is extremely important to the Shias and the Kurds, and that is the degree to which former members of the Ba'ath Party will be allowed to participate in Iraqi public life. And the document seems to draw a distinction between Ba'athists and Saddamists.
Well, what this gets at is the nature of the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'ath Party was like a big pyramid in structure, where if you wanted to get any state job in Iraq, most of the jobs were state jobs, or if you wanted to go to the university, you would have to join the Ba'ath Party. And so you had a couple million people who joined the Ba'ath Party. What they mean by Saddamists are people that actively participated, that would inform on their colleagues, that would do the types of things that you needed to do to advance to higher levels in the Ba'ath Party. And this is something that's been debated for quite some time. And just reading the Iraqi newspapers today, it's something that still is debated. Al-Basayir, which is the newspaper affiliated with the Muslim Scholars Association, which is one of the leading Sunni Arab groups, headlined, "What reconciliation are they talking about?" because of this debate. Mm-hmm. Whereas Al-Sabah al-Jadid, which is an independent newspaper, fully endorsed it. And then what you were talking about just before with regard to the Prime Minister's travels to Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait, Ad-Dastur, which is another independent newspaper, was saying that what really is needed more than amnesty is for Prime Minister Maliki to shut down the channels of terror finance, of insurgent finance, in these Gulf Arab countries that he's visiting.
And those Gulf Arab countries are, for the most part, Sunni, at least their leadership is.
Correct.
And there is considerable belief that, in fact, the insurgency in Iraq is largely funded by support from exactly those areas.
You're absolutely correct there. But in my recent trip, I spent most of the time in the north of Iraq this last trip. I tried to do that during the summers when mm-hmm. it gets really hot in the south. One of the big concerns wasn't necessarily the Sunni Arab insurgents, but some of the militia violence. For example, in Kirkuk, you have an active situation where it's not the Sunni Arabs which are targeting the Kurds now. It's members of Muqtada al-Sadr's Shiite militia. And so there's a lot of concern among Kurds and among talking to people in Baghdad and Basra, not about the Sunni insurgent violence, but the Shia militia violence. And it's not clear that this will really address that at all.
There is language in the National Reconciliation Plan about the militias, but in a document notably short on details, this is especially vague.
Exactly. There's really not much indication that the government's going to have the will to deal with this. Now, that said, this is a good start, and Prime Minister Maliki deserves the benefit of the doubt until he shows that he's not able to implement this, but we'll see what will happen. And of course, one of the other factors which needs to be considered is that there's no definite leadership among the so-called insurgents. There's many different groups, and as many scholars that go over and study this come up with just as many different answers. And the issue is if some groups stop, but other groups don't, what's that going to mean to ordinary Iraqis? I mean, honestly, most Iraqis who have been injured in car bombings that I've talked to don't really care who was the group that set off the car bomb. They just care that they were the victim of it. And so that adds to the complexity as well.
We're talking with Michael Rubin, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, about the proposed national reconciliation in Iraq. It's a wide-ranging program in which the government of Nouri al-Maliki, the new Iraqi prime minister, hopes to take advantage of the breathing space that they've been offered after the death of Mr. Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, after the completion of Mr. al-Maliki's government. And nevertheless, do you think, if you'd like to join the conversation, by the way, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email is talk@npr.org. The policy calls for the establishment of committees, again, even the size, who would be in charge, is not clear, but the idea is to open a dialogue on national reconciliation. Is that going to do any good if this committee doesn't have any actual power?
No, I don't think so. And oftentimes when we're talking about the Iraqi government, much of what impacts ordinary Iraqis takes place outside of the government corridors. Look, it's always good to have some sort of dialogue. What I would argue is that this dialogue is ongoing in the Iraqi press, and it might do the Iraqi politicians some good to look at what the political cartoonists are saying, to look at what the political commentators are saying, and to follow the debates, which are ongoing mm-hmm. much more transparently in the hundreds of newspapers which are sold in Baghdad and elsewhere every day.
And as you point out, the difficulties involved in if some of the insurgent groups come over but others do not, what has been accomplished?
Right, especially when in certain cases, part of the violence among the Sunni insurgents has not just been directed. It's too easy to say it's all directed at the occupation or it's all directed at sectarian or ethnic enemies. A lot of it is competition for leadership among the Sunni Arabs themselves, where different groups are trying to use violence to gain prominence. Historically, the Iraqi Kurds have always had their tribal leaders, the Barzanis, the Talibanis, and so forth. The Shiites have always had their religious hierarchy, the Ayatollahs in Najaf and Karbala, and the Iraqi Sunni Arabs have always had the central government in Baghdad. This is the first time in Iraqi history where the Sunni Arab community is without natural leaders, and so a lot of the violence which you see is actually Sunni Arab on Sunni Arab or perpetrated with an eye towards their constituency rather than with an eye towards revenge against their enemies.
As we look also at these militias, this is going to be more and more difficult as time goes on. For example, you have the two big Shiite militias associated with big elements within the ruling party in the country. And then, of course, in Kurdistan, the Peshmerga, the big Kurdish militia, which nobody in Kurdistan has any interest in disbanding at all.
No. The two different points. Whenever I go to Iraq, firstly about the two Shiite militias, the Jaish al-Mahdi of Muqtada al-Sadr and the Badr's Corps of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. What I try to do as an analyst is not just look at how many numbers they have or who I see on the streets, but to ask businessmen. If your scrap metal, for example, is a big business in Iraq, exporting scrap metal, and what I'll do is I'll ask businessmen, if you're going to export scrap metal, who do you have to get permits from? Who do you have to pay off? Do you just have to go to the central government, or do you have to go to the militias? And more often than not, what they say is, we have to pay off this militia here, that militia there, this guy's in charge of the ports, just to make everything flow. And that gives an indication of who's really in charge. When it comes to Iraqi Kurdistan, the Peshmerga are increasingly hated by ordinary people. I used to teach in Iraqi Kurdish universities, so a lot of my contacts there and the people who I stay with aren't members of the political parties, are just ordinary people, not particularly wealthy or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about some of the extortion. The independent Kurdish papers, Awina and Halati, have been full of examples recently of how, for example, one KDP member, Peshmerga member, was involved in a hit and run and was later captured and taken to the hospital. And the KDP Peshmerga, their militia, raided the hospital, wounded one of the hospital guards to take this guy out so that he wouldn't have to face charges in court. It's this type of corruption which is increasingly wearing on ordinary people there.
And corruption that's difficult to distinguish between operations to keep themselves going and simple crime.
Basically, yes. And the situation in Iraqi Kurdistan is a little bit better off than in the rest of the country. But when it comes to rule of law, there's some real problems. People used to talk about Iraqi Kurdistan as a beacon for democracy, and when compared to the governments in Syria, Iran, and under Saddam Hussein in Iraq, it certainly was. But there comes a time when they've got to stop resting on their laurels and actually make some progress, rather than just have this Potemkin democracy.
Michael Rubin, stay with us if you would. We'll take your calls after we come back from a break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. What are the prospects for Iraqi reconciliation? I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last month, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki laid out a national reconciliation plan that includes a proposal for limited amnesty for insurgents. After another weekend of bombings and kidnappings, is the 24-point plan still alive? Of course, you're invited to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guest is Michael Rubin, who's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and editor of Middle East Quarterly. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Hank. Hank's calling us from Centennial, Colorado.
Hi. I was wondering whether the experience in Lebanon offers any lessons for this situation. I don't know if you could say that they're successful there, but at least they seem to have achieved some sort of equilibrium between the warring factions.
It's an excellent question that Hank raises. The situation in Lebanon, just for a bit of clarification, within Lebanon, up to the Civil War and perhaps because of the Civil War, there was a fine balance that was achieved between ethnic and sectarian groups and the positions which they would hold within government, number one, and the proportions of power which they would have. And as Iraq has grown more ethnically and sectarianly divisive, many people have raised the question about whether such a model might work in Iraq. I tend not to be a fan of that model. First of all, populations always change, and the problem in Iraq is you haven't had a real census since 1957. If you take all of Iraq's various ethnic and sectarian groups, you ask them what proportion of the population they think they are, and you add it all up, Iraq is a country that has around 228% of its own population. And so that, first and foremost, is a problem. We're going to see some of this problem come to the forefront in December 2007 when the Iraqi constitution says that there has to be a census and a referendum in the ethnically mixed northern city of Kirkuk to see whether it will stay part of Iraq proper or whether it will join the Iraqi Kurdistan region, which is pretty much autonomous. There's also this trend within U.S. bureaucracy, especially within the defense democracy, the Defense Department, the Pentagon, to sort of bring up the Lebanon model as a way out. And the problem with all analogies is They can be useful mental models, but they can also be crutches which aren't too accurate. And if you're looking at creating some sort of military situation, unit training that's based on the Lebanese divisive model of the Lebanon military, I'm not sure that it will really do us much good, especially when there's still hope that ordinary people in Baghdad and so forth aren't as sectarianly, see themselves more as Iraqis than just their ethnic or religious groups. And so I think it might be a little bit too early to go down the Lebanon model, especially when the Lebanon model did get us a 15-year civil war.
And it should be pointed out, militias in Lebanon are not exactly unknown either.
No, I mean, I think it's UN Resolution 1559, I'm not sure whether I'm getting the number right, which calls for Hezbollah to disarm, and the Lebanese government has, to this point in time, not been able to fulfill that, which creates a real problem. I mean, at its root, the problem is are the militias, because the reason militias exist are to impose through force what the political groups can't necessarily get through the ballot box.
Hank, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. And Michael Rubin, thanks very much for taking time off from your holiday weekend. Appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and editor of Middle East Quarterly. Joining us now is Noah Feldman, a professor at New York University's School of Law, who's the author of After Jihad, which explores the prospects for democracy in the Islamic world, and he argues for a Western policy that more actively supports democratization. He's with us now by phone from his vacation home in Maine. Nice to have you back on the program, too.
Pleasure to be with you.
I know you've read the Maliki plan. What in it provides, do you think provides hope, and what needs some work?
I don't think it's the details that are going to get us to a solution. What it indicates, though, is that the Maliki government is prepared to deal, and they're sort of hanging out a shingle saying, okay, Sunni insurgents, come on in and let's engage in some negotiations. And initially, some did come in to negotiate, and at the same time, others who would like to derail the negotiations stepped up their violence, which is characteristic of any moment when there's a possibility for advancement.
The group that did come in, at least according to what we've heard publicly, these things are hard to work out, in terms of what exactly happened. But we're told that they had, in fact, two big objections to the plan, one of which involved calling for a 2-year time period for the withdrawal of American and allied forces.
It's true. One of the demands of Sunnis from the very beginning, really, has been a specific timetable for withdrawal as a crucial element. And the Iraqi government, and before them the U.S. government, has been resisting giving a date certain because they believe, rightly or wrongly, that that kind of modeling of an exact date would actually give an incentive to the more radical insurgents not to step down their violence, but to aim to simply disrupt negotiations until that date happens. Then if the withdrawal were actually to happen at that time, they would have a reasonable shot of rearranging power through violence instead of relying on the political process. The other alternative is to say that the U.S. will remain until a stable set of circumstances has been reached and only then begin to withdraw.
Mm-hmm. The other big objection, of course, was exactly what what amnesty is for.
That's true. And again, the amnesty question is rather an unclear one. In reality, on the ground, no one really believes that an Iraqi government would be able to go around finding people who participated in the insurgency and arresting them. What the insurgents want is a kind of guarantee for their top leaders that they'll be able to re-enter government and have jobs that involve some real power and some real economic clout. And I think that's the kind of objection that you're really hearing. Meanwhile, on the Western side, especially on the U.S. side, our Congress has been busy posturing about how we should never allow the Iraqis to engage in any sort of a deal that gives amnesty for people who've killed Americans, when on the ground it'll be impossible to say who killed Americans, who killed Iraqis, who killed civilians, and exactly what that amnesty really would mean in practice.
Let's see if we can get another caller in on this. I think we just lost that call. So let's try Steve. Steve's calling from Santa Rosa in California.
Yes, I'd like to get the guests to comment on the possible parallels between this situation and the one that the British find themselves in Northern Ireland, where those people had sectarian violence going back for perhaps hundreds of years. It seems in this region these people have grievances that go back perhaps 1,000 years or more. What are the chances that American soldiers are going to remain the targets of bombings and attacks for decades, as they have in Northern Ireland?
Well, I think, as British have in Northern Ireland, there's no American troops in Northern Ireland. Go ahead, anyway.
I think that Northern Ireland offers both hope and also a kind of realistic corrective. The hopeful part is that despite the more than a century of violence over the question of Northern Ireland, there has been substantial progress towards a political solution. And that's been because politicians who said they spoke for the gunmen were actually able to sit down with each other eventually and to cut a deal in which there were incentives for both sides. Now, that hasn't led to a perfect solution. And I think the thing we need to be realistic about is that even where there are politicians who want to make peace, more radical violent types can try to disrupt the peace settlement through it. And that we've seen that happen repeatedly in Northern Ireland. That's why we're not all mm-hmm. the way there. There,
it's though in Northern Ireland, as somebody there once told me, we're always hostage to the politics of the next atrocity. And if you're not taking decisive steps, one of the things that gradualism, one of the dangers of gradualism is that along the way, as you're trying to establish a dialogue, establish reconciliation, you just get overtaken by events.
That's quite right, and that's indeed what we've been seeing over the last long weekend. That the goal of the more radical insurgents has been to commit some major atrocities with the goal of getting everybody angry on all sides and derailing the political talks. And that is probably the single greatest risk to the success of a political settlement in Iraq.
Steve, thanks very much for the call.
Yes, the point I was trying to get at, of course, I was talking about the situation the British soldiers find themselves in, mm-hmm. in parallel to our soldiers. The question I was trying to get at was, what timetable for a realistic resolution? I mean, the British have been trying to solve that situation for decades.
It's true.
Are we going to find ourselves in a situation which takes decades to solve and undergo the kind of situation we've been seeing?
I would say the following, Steve. In the next year, we're either going to see very substantial political progress coupled with a reduction in violence, in which case our troops will remain with numbers gradually reducing for probably the next decade or two until things are really stable and they can be replaced by international peacekeeping types of troops. Or alternatively, over the next year, the political process will obviously fail. You know, you and I won't be having this conversation in a year. We'll see that it's failed. And if that happens, I think the U.S. is also going to start thinking about withdrawing troops probably faster and trying to control the civil war that I think almost certainly will emerge under those circumstances.
Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
And Noah Feldman, appreciate your time today.
My pleasure.
We'll let you get back to your holiday.
Thank you.
Noah Feldman, a professor at New York University School of Law, the author of After Jihad, and he joined us today by phone from his home in Maine. With another perspective is Kenneth Pollack, director of research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where he's also a senior fellow. He's with us by phone from his home in Maryland, and it's good of you to be with us today.
My pleasure, Neil. Good to be here.
And I know you've been listening to our last couple of guests. Do you have any great hopes that this reconciliation plan represents a beginning?
Absolutely. Look, I certainly think it's possible. And I think that what we ought to keep in mind is that what is truly remarkable about what's going on in Iraq is not how badly it's gone, but that it hasn't gotten worse. It's been over 3 years. The United States has made one mistake after another, many of these mistakes absolutely catastrophic. The Iraqis have nevertheless remained very consistent in their support of successful reconstruction. And honestly, that to me is the most surprising thing. If you had told me before we invaded that we were going to have no plan for post-war reconstruction, that we were not going to put in enough troops to hold the place together, that we were going to make mistake after mistake after mistake, and I won't recount all the ones that we made, and you were going to tell me that in July, three and a half almost years later, that the Iraqis were still not going to be in a state of all-out civil war, that it would just be a low-level civil war, I would have said, no way.
Nevertheless, there is a great deal of work to do, and the tinders of civil war are still there, in most analysts' belief.
Absolutely. I mean, I would argue that what we have in Iraq today is a low-level civil war. It is a low-level civil war produced by a whole variety of factors, but all of them stemming from the security vacuum which the United States created in April of 2003 and the failed state that we currently have in Iraq. You have a government in Iraq that exists only in the green zone. It is effectively incapable of providing basic security and basic services for the Iraqi people. And as I think you had Noah Feldman spokesman just say, the biggest problem out there is that the Iraqi people are looking, are beginning to look to others, in particular to the militias, to provide them with the basic security and basic services that they so desperately need. What's important about al-Maliki's reconciliation plan and many of the other steps he's taken, in all honesty, I actually think the most important thing going on is not the reconciliation plan at all. It's this new Baghdad security plan, which for the first time promises to maybe actually start to create security on the ground for a very important part of Iraq. If he can do that, if he can start to show Iraqis that he's actually going to deliver on security and basic services, they will stick with him. The point that Noah Feldman just made, which is a very important one, is that if in the next 6 months the Iraqis conclude that Maliki's government can't do it, the way that Jafari's government couldn't do it, the way that Ayat Alawi's couldn't, the way that Jerry Bremer's CPA couldn't, and the way that Orha couldn't, then I think you're going to see the Iraqis turn very quickly to the militias and the whole place is going to come apart.
We're talking about the prospects of Iraqi reconciliation, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get a caller in. This is Brian. Brian's calling us from North Dartmouth in Massachusetts.
Hi. I had a question about al-Qaeda in Iraq. You know, we had these claims of Port of Goss that it is now a prime recruiting area. In some ways, the invasion of Iraq created a failed nation state. And I was wondering how influential al-Qaeda is. You know, Zarqawi was at war with the idea of Iraq. Are Iraqis joining al-Qaeda, and is it for me a threat to the Maliki's plan that there are people that obviously we want to deconstruct the state and the progress?
Look, there's no question that al-Qaeda in Iraq and a variety of other Salafi jihadist groups, these very virulent Sunni terrorist groups that are in Iraq, are part of the problem there. They are among the most vicious. They are interested not only in killing Americans, but even more than that, they're interested in killing Shia. Now, that said, they're only a part of the problem, probably a small part of the problem. What we're seeing in Iraq is increasingly that the violence there is Sunni on Shia, but it is also Sunni on Sunni and Shia on Shia. And one of the interesting things to me is that in the last 3 or 4 months, the Western media has discovered what's going on in Basra. Basra is Iraq's largest Shia city in the south, and there has been mayhem in Basra for about the last 18 months, with people coming back saying every night we walk out into the street and there are a dozen bodies, very prominent people lying there. These are all Shia, and it's Shia on Shia violence. And al-Qaeda in Iraq certainly has helped stir the pot, but they are only a very small part of the real problems in the country. And ultimately, if the U.S. and the new Iraqi government could solve the problem of the militias, both Sunni and Shia, and not deal with the problem of al-Qaeda, the new government of Iraq can probably survive. If they deal with the problem of al-Qaeda, but they're unable to get a control of the militias, they can't possibly survive.
If, as you say, al-Qaeda are a small, you know, problem in Iraq. You know, I think the reports say that about 5 to 10% of the insurgents are actually al-Qaeda. What does this say about the claims that if America disengages from Iraq, or if we, quote-unquote, cut and run, that it will automatically become a center or a base for, you know, transnational jihadi terrorism?
Sure. Good question. First, just a minor correction. About 5% of the fighters in Iraq are foreign. They belong to, we believe, about a dozen different terrorist groups, of which al-Qaeda in Iraq is just one. So al-Qaeda is even a smaller percentage than that. You know, you're raising a very important question, which is that if Iraq goes down the tubes, if we have all-out civil war in Iraq, if Iraq turns into Bosnia or Lebanon in the 1970s and 1980s, you know, it certainly is true. I think what the president is saying is absolutely accurate, that it will become a bigger breeding ground and a bigger haven for terrorists, the way that Afghanistan did. Friends of mine who are counterterrorism experts suggest it'll be even bigger than Afghanistan was. That said, that's not the only problem going on in Iraq, and quite honestly, if Iraq does go into that state of all-out civil war, I don't think that's the biggest problem that the United States is going to face. You know, we've seen these kind of failed states, these kind of civil wars before, and while the terrorism element is always a painful one, the bigger problems are things like massive refugee flows, the radicalization of neighboring populations, which sometimes causes these civil wars to spread, intervention of neighboring states, which can lead a civil war to become a regional war or cause the states that are intervening to fail themselves. Those are the kind of things that I think we need to focus on. The al-Qaeda issue is there, but we shouldn't let it dominate the agenda.
Brian, thank
you. I hear what you're saying, and I also agree. But there's one that you didn't mention, and that is that many people in Iraq are against al-Qaeda, you know, the Sufis, the Shiites, the Kurds, and you have these instances of transnational jihadi foreign fighters being killed by tribesmen in Anbar province.
Right.
Isn't there a potential that the Iraqi people will themselves sort out this problem, just as, say, the Afghans did when they pushed out bin Laden in 1988, 1989,
Brian, all good questions, but we're going to have to put you on hold and answer them after we get back from a break, because we're up against the clock. So hang on, if you would. I'm going to put you on hold, and whoops, I hung up on you. Well, by mistake. I apologize. Mr. Clever strikes again. Ken Pollack, though, remembers every detail of your question and will answer it after this break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are the headlines from some of the stories we're following here today at NPR News. Palestinian militants have given Israel less than a day to start releasing hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, suggesting that they would kill an abducted Israeli soldier if their demands are not met. Israel's military has waged an offensive in Gaza in an effort to force the militants to release the soldier. Also, politics in Mexico is in limbo, as both candidates in this weekend's presidential election have declared victory. That's the two top candidates. The election was so close, votes will have to be counted by hand. A winner is not expected to be known until later this week. Details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, we'll celebrate Independence Day with the reduced Shakespeare Company's Fast and Furious take on American history, The Complete History of America, abridged tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. And in a few minutes, we'll get to the Talk of the Nation opinion page. This week, an argument that the human brain makes us more afraid of terrorism, say, than global warming, even if the odds don't agree. If you have questions about the way our brain perceives threats and what it means, give us a call. 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Email is talk at npr.org. Still with us to talk about the process of reconciliation in Iraq is Ken Pollack, Director of Research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where he's also a senior fellow. I apologize again for hanging up on our caller. Ken Pollack's with us only because I can't hang up on him. But anyway, if he was asking a question just before the break about the considerable portion of Iraqis, including the Kurds, for example, very much opposed to groups like al-Qaeda.
Right, and there's no question that the vast majority of the population doesn't like al-Qaeda in the country. In fact, there's evidence that even the Sunni community isn't thrilled with having them there. But again, to go back to a fundamental point, unless we and the new Iraqi government can change the nature of the conflict in Iraq, reduce people's fears, make them believe that there is a better future ahead of them, no one is going to take any action against al-Qaeda, in particular not the Sunni community, which are the ones who have to root them out from within their own streets.
And what is going to succeed in doing that, turning over security to Iraqi forces that are perceived as being fair?
Not necessarily. You know, again, we use Hassan, you know, kind of catchphrases like that that actually disguise the nature of the problem. It's certainly true that a lot Iraqis like to see Iraqi forces out on the streets, but quite frankly, they also like to see the Americans behind them, because many of the Iraqis are very concerned about the allegiance of these Iraqi units. It actually makes them feel better in most cases to know that there are mixed American and Iraqi formations. And in fact, our most successful generals in Iraq have been the ones who've integrated American and Iraqi units, putting the Iraqis out front, but making sure that the Americans were behind them, provide them support if they got into trouble, and make sure they don't run amok.
Let's see if we can get another caller in. Marcel calling from California.
Oh, hi. My name is Marcel. Actually, I'm a British Kurdish, and actually, I was listening to the other gentleman. He was comparing Kurdish militia, Peshmerga, with the Shiite militia. I just want to tell that gentleman is absolutely, there is no comparison there. But, you know, when we talk about Peshmerga, we're talking about the same people who fought Iraqi regime previous one for 8 years, defending our democracy, and you talk about a bunch of militia in the towns of Iraq, backed by Iran, religious and fundamental. And that gentleman spoke about one incident. It was just a kind of hit and run. I mean, that's happened everywhere. There's corruption everywhere. There's corruption in America. There's corruption in Iraq, everywhere. You can't just take one example, one small incident, and say everybody else is corrupt. There is corruption, but like anyone else, like in America.
Marcel, excuse me, Marcel, you're speaking very fast, but yes, he was saying that you cited the one incident you talked about, but what he was basically saying is that the Peshmerga are no longer quite so popular as they were in that way. I'm not sure that he was drawing a direct comparison to the Shiite militias.
Okay, there's something. The peacemaker, they were same people were advancing American's army to fight and Iraqis. They were same. I mean, do you know what...
I hear you, Marcel, and I think what he's saying is talking to Kurds that he knows and reading the Kurdish press, the Peshmerga is less popular. That's his opinion. You can disagree.
I'll tell you what. Yeah, I'm sure there's corruption. They've done a few things wrong. But there's something else, actually. I mean, for Americans and for the West, they need to know something. And I'm a Kurdish. I'm a very proud for American and British Army to be in Iraq. And this is... I represent quite a lot of Kurds. You know, I know we're happy you guys are in Iraq. We want you to stay permanently. I mean, I love to have an American and British Army permanently in Iraq. I mean, I couldn't agree more. We need to all go out, fight the fundamental, and get rid of all the religion problem. And
right.
There's something else, actually. Do you know what they call us in the Middle East? And by Arab, they called us the second Israelis in the Middle East. I'm very proud to be called the second Israelis because we are anti-Qaeda and the older terrorists and the older fundamental. And I want to tell, as a Kurdish person and as a British, we're very, very proud to have you.
And Michael, we thank you very much for the call. Excuse me, Marcel, we thank you very much for the call. And let's see if we can get one of our final call on Ken Pollack. This is Scott. Scott calling us from Anchorage.
Yes, I've experienced a little bit of anarchy in my short life. I was in Zimbabwe in 1986. I was in Rhodesia in 1978. So I just can't believe that we're going to be able to get the stabilization that we want without allowing an amnesty. It didn't work in our own civil war with Reconstruction. We had to allow Confederates to have power. The people who have a strong voice in their local community have always been people who would take up arms against an invader.
And what do you say to the parents of dead Americans and dead Britons who fought to liberate Iraq and to see their killers put into power afterwards?
The same thing that I would say to the dead Union, to the parents of dead Union members. It's a necessity. We tried to overthrow everyone, and it didn't work. You have to recognize... You know, if you were to bring in tanks on my little piece of land, I am going to fight back.
Mm-hmm. Ken Pollack, the extent of this amnesty is, of course, critical and highly debatable.
Absolutely. Although, I've got to say, Neil, I tend to agree with Scott. I think that what we've seen time and again historically is that the only way that you achieve some form of peace and national reconciliation in the wake of these kind of horrendous civil wars is to have a widespread amnesty. Those who are most guilty, those who, like Ratko Mladic in the former Yugoslavia, who just had untold amounts of blood on their hands, they need to be brought to trial. But the grunts, the fighters on the street, they have to be amnesty. There's no way to account for who killed whom, and ultimately they're just going to be too many of those people. And, you know, I think that your question about, well, what do you say to the parents of people who had sons and daughters killed in Iraq, I think is a very good one. But I think that the real answer there is that ultimately your sons, your daughters went to Iraq in the hope of achieving something. And that something was to build a stable, prosperous new Iraq. There is no way that we are ever going to achieve that stable, prosperous new Iraq unless we can help the communities there find a way to get past their current problems and find ways to live with each other in peace, as they have actually for centuries. We greatly exaggerate the problems between Sunnis and Shia within Iraq, within the Arab community. And the greatest way that we can honor our dead is to actually succeed in the mission for which they gave their lives. If we can't succeed, then what have they died for?
Scott, thanks very much for the call.
Certainly.
And Ken Pollack, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Neil. Great to be here.
Ken Pollack, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he is also director of research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy. When we come back, the Talk of the Nation opinion page.